This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 59 for Monday, April 20th, 2009, jQuery.
This week we have an interview with Brennan Staling, a developer from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Brennan talks about the history of jQuery and some of the cool things he's been doing with it. Let's listen to the interview. Hi, this is Larry. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of The Thirsty Developer. Today I'm in downtown Milwaukee, and I've run into my friend Brennan. Brennan, can you introduce yourself to everybody?
Hi, I'm Brennan Staling. I work down in Third Ward in Milwaukee at Full House.
So, Brennan, today we're going to talk a little bit about one of my favorite hot new topics, and I've mentioned it on the show a couple of times, is I'm really getting into JavaScript.
Yeah.
I'm trying to actually learn the language for the first time. And it sounds kind of ridiculous because I've been using JavaScript for like 10 years, but I really don't know it. Like a lot of people, what I've done is like I've found other people's JavaScript that kind of did what I wanted to do, and I paste it in and then kind of start hacking around on it. But what I've noticed is just like other languages, JavaScript itself, the language is nice, right? It's functional. But you really get a lot of power out of frameworks that you build on top of that.
Yeah.
And today we're going to talk about my favorite framework now is jQuery.
Yep.
And I've asked you on the show because you're what I deem as an expert on jQuery. And let me tell you this story, because you don't know this.
Okay.
We didn't actually talk about this before we started recording, is that you were the first person that ever mentioned jQuery to me.
Really?
Yes. So that's why I'm deeming you an expert, because you've been messing around with it a lot longer than I have. So
yeah. So
what got you started in using jQuery?
I was actually messing around with a lot of different libraries. I was trying out, you know, MooTools, Prototype, other, you know, pretty popular frameworks that are out there that kind of grew and shrank, you know, over time. They got popular, and you know, Prototype's really powerful. MooTools are really powerful, but they're also kind of big at times, a little too big for your purposes, possibly. So the power of jQuery, you know, is it's very tiny, but then it has a plugin model. So if you need to do something, just go ahead and browse for plugins, and there's probably, you know, if you're trying to do a common UI thing that is a good usability for what you're doing, you're probably going to find a plugin for it.
And yeah, and for completeness, we should mention, like, you know, ASP.NET Ajax. You know, we have to mention that it's a great framework.
Mm-hmm.
It's built into Visual Studio and the .NET framework, so it's got a lot of advantages there. What I like about ASP.NET Ajax is unlike all the ones we're going to talk about, we're going to primarily talk about jQuery today. You know, all those are client-side libraries, and ASP.NET Ajax is kind of unique in the fact that it's got a server-side component and a client-side component, which makes it really powerful. And that gives you some interesting combinations of things that you can do. Like the script manager does a lot of things for you. jQuery is 100% client-side library. So it's got some, I wouldn't call them limitations, but it's got, you know, that's where its bounds is.
It has a focus.
Yeah. But there are some really neat things about it. And you mentioned the size of it for one, but kind of tell us how jQuery started.
Well, the guy who created it is John Resig. That's really why I got into it, probably, and why I focused on it, and why a lot of people got into it, because the guy is so good. He's so good with what JavaScript can do. He wrote a book called Pro JavaScript Techniques. When I read that book, I relearned how to do JavaScript. It was a completely, you know, it's functionality that was always in the language that nobody really knew how to use properly. So what is a functional language, and the fact that it's dynamic, and how to declare functions and callbacks and use closures and all these language features that I didn't know were in there. And they're in C# too, but nobody really uses them there, because they're just sort of these obscure language features which are required in JavaScript, because JavaScript, you want to do something and it's an asynchronous call, like a web service call,
right?
Through Ajax callback, and you need to attach a callback to run when it completes. It's just like you would do async calls in C#. So I read his book, and in that book he covered a library called CSS Query, which sort of might have been the beginnings of jQuery.
Kind of the genesis of it, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he created that, but he learned a lot from that, and he kind of ran with it. And in that book, he actually explains how to write a CSS query engine to kind of traverse the DOM. And JavaScript, the DOM API, is really, really hard.
And let's describe what the DOM is real quick.
The DOM is, you know, sort of centered around one function among other functions that are less used, but get element by ID. And you're gonna go and grab that ID. It's gonna give you an element, and then from that element you can traverse the children, and you know, you can use the DOM API to set attributes or do things to the elements inside of it, like you're traversing an XML structure.
Yeah, and DOM is you know, just to be complete with the definition, it's document object model.
Yeah.
And if you look at every HTML web page that comes at you, there's a hierarchy and a structure to it, right? You know, everything's got a root. And then you at HTML, right?
Yep.
And then under that, you've got child nodes like head is the first one you see in most web pages, right? And then you've got body. And each and every element that you define in HTML is represented in the object model. And your browser is using that to display it. Mm-hmm. But also what's so powerful about modern browsers is that you can actually query that. And they pretty much all subscribe to, you know, a standard DOM model. There's some differences in how they display it and all that.
They're supposed to implement the same DOM API, and they do, but there's nuances and differences between them. Like, between Safari and Firefox and Internet Explorer, and different versions of Internet Explorer, some of the implementations of those functions might be native. And some might actually be script implemented. So the ones that are native are actually extremely fast compared to the scripted versions.
Right.
So what you do in jQuery, what John Resigan and the jQuery team have done, is they've fine-tuned the implementation underneath the covers so that you can get better performance every single time you put new version of jQuery. So they go from jQuery 1.2.1 to 1.2.6, and suddenly the performance of your app goes a lot faster, just like going from .NET 1.1 to .NET 2.0. It's suddenly the runtime is different. The indexing and type data sets got much faster. Same thing happens in jQuery, where they discover new optimizations, they implement that, and you benefit from that automatically.
And so jQuery is using the DOM, and it's using the power of JavaScript, and it's abstracting it down to a nice layer.
Yeah.
Right. So that you're working, if you look at jQuery, you're working with the jQuery interface to a lot of these things. You're not having to deal with the actual DOM implementation. So let's give some couple examples of things that you could do with jQuery, just so that everybody who's listening can kind of wrap their head around it. And we'll give some people some pointers about what's the latest version and what the websites are. But for right now, give me an example of something that you would do with jQuery.
In general, what you can do a lot of times these days is actually replace Flash functionality with native just JavaScript. It's like you want to do this complicated interaction on a web page. Normally, if you had to write all that JavaScript against the DOM API and manipulate all the HTML and then test it across all the browsers, it's a lot of work. But with something like with jQuery, you can pretty much write the JavaScript and be pretty safe that it's going to work in all the browsers, at least the JavaScript will. You know, you still have to deal with some of the HTML and CSS issues, but, you know, it's a lot easier. So, you know, what I was working on is a kind of like a rollover effect for a menu system, and it just happens to be the images that were behind that were being replaced with the ones that come up on top were not the same size, so I couldn't use a simple image replacement rollover.
Okay.
So I used a prototyping process where I wrote all the HTML, I wrote the CSS to layer things properly using 3-4 divs, you know, from 1, 2, 3 down the page. Say they're like 100 pixels high and 300 pixels wide. I would, the second and third and fourth, I actually put a negative margin to push it up. And it's sort of like doing relative positioning with absolute positioning and z-indexing, but I don't have to mess around with z-indexes or anything. And I was able to push them on top of each other. And then the bottom layer that went, last node in the DOM that I pushed up on top of everything was on top of everything, so I could do mouse overs on that. I controlled it using the hover method in jQuery so that I could handle all the mouse over out and in type of stuff, and it just was really easy to do.
Well, I was going to give a lot simpler of an example. So I'll give mine, right?
Okay. Well, the simpler example is opening and closing a little block, you know. So you have a common interface these days, tagging. You know, you want to add tags, so like you have a cool little photo, and you want people to be able to tag it. You know, I want to tag it as Milwaukee or Midwest or Summerfest or whatever. But you don't want to have that form sitting there on every page, so you want to expand it. So you can have an icon that you can click it. It'll then slide open a form, and then you enter your tag, you press click, it flips over, it says thank you, and then it collapses. And that you can use the slide up and slide down function, and it just does all the work. So you click it, call slide up, click it, slide down, and it's done.
So what you're doing there is you're expanding and hiding the form element that somebody would input based on if they want to use it, as opposed to it always being there,
yeah,
sitting there.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good example.
It's a really good way of, like, you know, maximizing your real estate on the web page, which I'm really trying to do more and more all the time, where, you know, people are always fighting for content space on the homepage. And a good way to do that is to make the content expandable. You see this a lot on the news websites. They do it very well on a lot of websites. MSNBC does a lot of very dynamic stuff that content's always kind of sliding in. And, you know, there's usually like two or three frames in the same space that you can click to, like, oh, I want to go to sports or politics or whatever. And you can kind of see that content really quickly without having to jump around Navigator everywhere. So, but that's really easy to do with jQuery.
Okay, and let's talk about a very simple use case and then talk about the constructs of jQuery that make it so easy, so powerful. And I know you can do this server-side, but let's say you can't do it server-side for some reason. And that is that if you had a table, you know, that was really tabular data, we know we shouldn't use tables for layout anymore, right? But if you had a table of data and you wanted to color every other one, you know, like a light gray, so it's a little easier to read, easier to spot the values that are similar in a column. jQuery uses the concept of a selector that's part of the
CSS
framework. Yeah, and so tell us what a selector is, and then, you know, how you would actually do that. And then we'll talk about a wrap set separately.
Okay. Well, the basic elements that you get in HTML, they call them tags if you're, like, going HTML way, but it's also XML if you're thinking XHTML. So you'll often call them elements, and you're going to be gathering a collection of elements by running a selector. And a selector is basically a CSS selector where I can say div.classname. And so if I have a bunch of divs with the normal or even or odd, for like this example, I could do that. But putting those class values in there for even and odd is not necessary if you're using jQuery. jQuery actually can interpret more selector syntax than all the browsers can. So you can use div, or actually for a table, you have, like, you know, the table tag. Then you have the TR for the row, and then you have a TD. If you want, you can go and grab all the odds by going table space TD colon odd.
It would be a TR, right? Because you want to do all the
TR,
rows.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so you grab all the odd ones, and then if you want to do something with that.
And then you could say background color equal gray, right?
And that's something I don't do that often, actually. What I try to do as much as possible, I want to be able to still control the page with CSS. So what I will do is I'll put the styling that I want to come up into a class selector.
Right, and then you could add the class.
And then I add and remove classes to elements, and that gives me great power, and then it helps me work with the designers that will be working on the CSS.
So that's a great example of a selector, right? Table.tr.odd, right? So that's going to return to you all of those. One of the things about jQuery that's so powerful is that syntax language, you know, is very, and I hate to use the word dynamic because we're going to overload the term dynamic, right? But it's very powerful in selectors. Because if you actually started at the, you know, at the root element, or let's say that you just did table.tr, you would actually return every table that was on the page.
Yeah, every TR. Yeah.
Right. So you can do it a little, you can use the power of identification in the DOM and either query a table specifically by its ID, or you could do it by the class associated with it. So you could say, so if my table was upcoming events, my table was actually a tabular data of events, I could say, give me the ID equal events table, right? And then that way it's only going to select that one.
Yeah.
You could also do it positionally. So you could say, give me the first table on the page.
Yes.
That's dangerous and fraught, right? Because what if somebody else comes in and adds another table, you know, in place? But you could use classes. So let's say you have multiple events tables on every page. You could just use the class equal events to do the selection. So, and what I want to get here is not try to get to every nuance because jQuery is very powerful. But there's a lot of different ways that you can select stuff. It's almost as powerful as selecting from a database.
Well, think of it like it's like an XPath. But this XPath syntax might be a little harder.
I would call it terse, harder.
And, and where this almost is a notation that's actually a lot more, it's easier to see, you know, see what's going on.
Yeah, because I can actually, you know, once I understand, you know, once I spend like probably 20, 30 minutes looking at jQuery and somebody explains it to me, I can look at any syntax and tell you in plain English, this is kind of what's going to be returned.
Yeah.
Oh, he's querying this div tag every table that's in with in there. So if you had more than one table, you would actually get two results in the wrap set.
Mm-hmm.
You like my segue to wrap sets there? Because wrap sets is another critical function to jQuery. And this is like the selectors are powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The wrap set is the return from the selector, right? So
yeah.
Yeah, I'm stealing your definition. You're the expert. So what's a wrap set?
Well, every time you do something, well, not every time, but most times when you call jQuery, you call, you know, pass in a selector, it gives you a result of, you know, one or more, maybe none results. You know, it returns a collection of elements. And say I do something like I add a class value to each of those matched elements, that result of that add class method call will then return the same set. And it's, you know, like it's a fluent interface, you know, which is pretty common these days. So I can then pass the same result set to the next method, to the next method, and I can chain multiple methods. So if I want to add a class, I want to set the height, I want to do a bunch of things to this thing. What's great about that, and there's, you know, it's for performance reasons as well, because every single time I query the page and try to find all the matching elements, it takes time. So by using the same seven matches against those seven, you know, whatever number of calls I make on it, it's a lot faster. So the fluent interface isn't just for aesthetics, it's actually for performance as well.
Right. And what's if people are familiar with Unix programming, you know, or command line programming,
yeah,
you know, DOS, it's piping,
yeah.
You know, that it's taking the output of one command and sending it to the next command as
yeah.
the input there. It's really powerful when you combine that with the selector language that we talked about a minute ago.
Yeah.
Because what it allows you to do is say, let me get all the div tags, and then I can do a separate operation on those. So I could narrow things down. And as you said, you're not querying the page again, so you get into the performance. But also you can chain things together. So you can say, first I want to get a set of elements. I want to create div tags for all of them and put values in those div tags. And then I want to go through and I want to disable all the form elements in there.
Yeah.
You can do all of that in literally one line of jQuery.
Yep.
And the chaining is really powerful to show that, you know, one mm-hmm. right after another.
Yeah, and the nice thing about that as well is, you know, Microsoft basically has embraced jQuery so that they're working pretty closely with the jQuery team, and they released the VS doc files so that when you are chaining things together and you're going to the next thing, we will actually get the IntelliSense support that they've built into JavaScript. It's pretty good right now. It's getting a lot better in 2010. So,
let's talk about what a VS doc file is.
A VS doc file, sometimes JavaScript cannot be parsed because JavaScript can be really, really extremely dynamic. One really good example of that is the event attachments that you can do in jQuery. When you call click or double click or mouse over, you can call them by doing, you know, jQuery query dot click. What that actually is doing is calling bind, passing the parameter click, and then attaching the function that you might be giving it to that function, to attach that function. There's a whole collection of, like, you know, 10, 20 different event types that you can do that with. And the way that's done, there's a collection there's a string that when jQuery is when it is loaded and interpreted, it will split on a comma, pull all the strings out, iterate over array, and actually create all those functions dynamically. They don't actually exist. So when Visual Studio parses the code looking for functions, they don't exist, you know.
Right.
So what they've done with VSDoc is they created a jQuery special VSDoc that actually has all those things unfolded with documentation in there so that you can actually get the IntelliSense.
Yeah, and this gives you, like, true IntelliSense
yeah.
on the language itself.
The parameters, the return values.
Well, I shouldn't say on the language itself. It gives you, you know, syntax.
Methods.
By default, everything in JavaScript, all the normal functions are there in IntelliSense in Visual Studio. What this does is says the specific jQuery functions I'm going to give you IntelliSense for.
Yeah.
Really powerful stuff. You know, we should do a screencast together to show this. And
I take advantage of it a lot. I combine jQuery very often with web services. So either it's an Azimex web service or...
Oh, you're jumping up ahead too far. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I do want to complete a little bit talking about the jQuery things, because you mentioned a piece of functionality that you could do, like slide in, slide out.
Mm-hmm.
There are I don't know what the exact term is, but they're almost like helper routines in jQuery that lets you do interesting UI effects and do them in a nice, clean way.
Yeah.
So what you could do is that you know, slide in and slide out is one of them that you can actually have
slide up, slide down. And what it's actually doing is it's just animating the height value. So when you're I always confuse which one is which. Slide up, slide down, where it's basically decreasing the height to zero and then hiding that element completely. And then when you open it, it will be increasing the height to its effective height. Really simple concept, but something you're going to use a lot because it's a really good usability piece.
Well, it can be overused. It can be abused,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
But, you know, used properly, you know, it's a great way of giving the user a visual clue that something is kind of out of focus right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Without having it just disappear.
Yeah.
Because that can be very jarring, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a nice, pleasing way of doing it. And prior to or without something, a client-side library to help you with this stuff, it was really onerous to do that, and it was very wired to that specific set of elements.
For a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
You know, like the animation routine, how do you do that? Do you do set timeouts and then set the timeouts for every 20 milliseconds and do that, or do you set an iteration? If you ever try to do animations and you try to throw a lot of things going on at the same time, you will find that the browser gets a little sluggish because JavaScript in the browser was never meant for doing a lot of stuff. I mean, JavaScript 12 years ago was used to check form elements for calculator type of stuff and forms, you know. It wasn't meant for what we're doing now with like these Web 2.0 websites. You know, you go to Facebook, all these things are sliding up and down, moving around, and it's really great. But, you know, you kind of have to be sensitive with the performance. Like, you know, game development or whatever on native hardware, they spend a lot of time. But in a web browser, even more so, you can't get away with all that stuff. So you want to be sensitive to that. And so if you can use the built-in animation routines, you know, slide up, slide down, fade in, fade out. What's the other one? There's a few others. Or you can go straight to the animate routine, which actually will help you out and do a lot of other animations for you. And you don't have to worry about whether you're doing set timeout or set interval. It just takes care of it for you.
Okay, so now we can start talking about server-side functionality.
Okay.
Because one of the other cool things, and by the way, we're only going to cover like 1/20th of what jQuery can do. And we'll give people some resources at the end of this to go learn more. But one of the other things that you can do is it has a great set of libraries for calling server-side functions,
mm-hmm.
for calling AJAX mm-hmm. routines or JSON routines. So there's like a dollar $get,
mm-hmm.
and there's a dollar $get JSON.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's several
and whatnot.
Yeah, there's several functions, and this is where the real client-side power comes in, right? Because all the things that we've talked about doing selectors, setting CSS classes, making things, you know, animate, you know, in a pleasing fashion, are, you know, you're limited if you're just dealing with what's in the client side. This library allows you to reach out to AzimX, RESTful services, anything that exposes JSON in the back end, right?
Yeah.
And get data, operate on it, and then do some cool things on the client side.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about that.
You can go directly using the get and post and get JSON. You can use those methods directly, but a lot of times I just go ahead and use AzimX and WCF services directly by marking them as AJAX friendly.
Right.
And there's different techniques for doing that. I don't remember the syntax off the top of my head right now, but you know, you can basically take an AzimX service, you mark it as a script resource, I believe is the attribute that you put on it, and suddenly you can call that as a web service. So you add that to your script manager as a script service reference. And then I add all my jQuery and everything else through Script Manager as well, so I make sure they're in the right order that I need them in. It takes care of that for me. And then I can call the web services. And part of the VS doc thing that I do, you pull up the web service in the browser. You'll see it like, you know, so you have a service called userservice.asmx. You put that into the web browser, you'll see the standard, you know, web service page. But you put /js or /jsdebug at the very end, it will then change into JavaScript. If you put jsdebug, it has documentation that you can use. So what I will do is I'll copy and paste that into a JS file where it'll be userservice-vsdoc.js. And then I'll add the reference to whatever my custom script is. And then I get IntelliSense support against that web service, which is really powerful. So I can now check out, you know, see if a user's got this, that, or I can add or remove, you know, this if this item's a favorite or not, things like that.
And what you're doing there is that's cool. you're actually talking about mixing standard ASP.NET Ajax.
The integration is so clean.
And,
it's easy.
And jQuery. What's nice about that is that, that the designers of both those libraries, you know, understood that, hey, we're not going to be the end-all, be-all to everybody. Mm-hmm. We've got to live and play with other, you know, Ajax libraries. So all of them support the ability, you know, to avoid namespace collisions and things like that. But the ASP.NET Ajax, because of its server-side component that we talked about, and its, you know, deep intimate understanding of like WCF, you know, services and all that, combined with the client-side power of jQuery is a fantastic combination. One of the things that comes up when you mention that to somebody, like you show it on the same page, like here's ASP.NET Ajax and here's jQuery, they go, why would you do that? Because the file sizes are, you know, you're going to have two libraries. Together, they're not huge. Mm-hmm. And if you're using them on every page, they're cached on the first page. And I think we've kind of gotten over the fact that JavaScript libraries are big. At least I think we have.
Well, it's getting better. I mean, the way I've been doing it, where I use a script manager and you sort of have almost a penalty where it will put a bunch of, there's like three or four references it puts in there for all the sys namespace content.
Right.
So that's going to be in there. And it gives you like access to like a string builder object and, you know, other things that you might want to use. And then it'll also have all the web service support that you would have in there for your web service proxies, essentially. And then you have your jQuery. So that could get up to like over 100 to 200K, possibly. So there's lots of blogs out there that explain how to go directly against something and not have to use the sys namespace code. I think Rigsby's probably written about that a couple of times at least.
Yep.
So you can go directly against these services. I don't have a problem with the way it is right now. I am really excited about MVC coming up because if you saw the Hanselman did a presentation on building Nerd Dinner, and one of his examples was instead of returning a view, which was HTML, he actually returned a JSON view.
Right.
So instead of me having to mark up my ASMX service as a script resource or decorate and configure my WCF services to be Ajax friendly, which is, you know, a bit more work than I would like, I can now just have a really nice URL routed path and have it return JSON. And I have like these RESTful services that can be easily consumable by my JavaScript. And that way I don't even have to, you know, do much. I just know that, oh, I'm going to go slash here, user, and I'm already authenticated using forms authentication.
Right.
So my user knows, you know, the server knows who this user is, so I can now say, add this item as a favorite for this user. And I call a RESTful service, passing in the parameters with the values I want, and it's done. It's really easy.
And you and I have talked about another alternative to that is that I really got into ADO.NET data services
because
they'll expose the same kind of RESTful interface, and it's really cool when you combine the two, you know, being able to call into the database using the JSON piece of it. What I like about it is it allows you to scale your web tier separate from your services tier, and you could get some phenomenal performance in it because you're putting a lot of work on the client. Mm-hmm. I feel that I've reinvented client server is what I've done, Brennan. You know, it's like let's take advantage of the local, you know processing.
And it's really great that we're heading in this direction because, you know, it enhances the web interface. But what it's also doing is you're creating these endpoints, these service endpoints that can be used by mobile applications. So if you want to create an application for your phone, you can use those same endpoints, and that's pretty powerful.
Now, for completeness, you mentioned it at the very beginning, but we have to mention real quick the plugin architecture with jQuery.
Yeah. The plugin architecture is pretty simple. What you will do is they have a very specific way of doing it that will help you avoid certain problems with scoping and namespace issues. It's very clean. Learning how to build a jQuery plugin will actually teach you a lot about JavaScript and how to properly manage scoping. So if you go ahead and do that, you'll find that there's a thing called a module pattern where it's just like algebra where you're adding two numbers but you're also multiplying in the same expression. You want to make sure you add before you multiply because, you know, multiply is supposed to take precedence.
Right.
So you put parentheses around the addition part. So same thing in JavaScript. If you want some code to be isolated, you can actually put it inside of parentheses. And so what John Resig has been doing quite a bit with jQuery and jQuery plugins is you start a statement with parentheses, put a function in there, anonymous function, open and close that function, put all your code inside that function. At the end of the squiggly bracket that closes the function, actually create a double paren that would basically execute that anonymous function immediately. Put all your code that you want run inside that, and then none of the code that you put in there, any variables or any functions you declare, will actually be in the global scope at all.
Right.
And that's just really clean. So that's how a lot of jQuery plugins are built, where what you're going to do is you're going to define your functionality and you're going to attach that to jQuery. So if I want to create a, you know, get a drink for Thirsty Developer, I create that function and attach it to the $dot and call it that, and I'll have that function available to me.
Yeah, and a lot of the closure and isolation is specifically to avoid collisions with other plugins that you may be referencing.
Yeah.
And the plugin architecture is very elegant. All plugins require jQuery to be there. You know, so you've got to have the base library, mm-hmm. so you don't have to reinvent things like the selectors and all that, mm-hmm. right? What you do is that, let's say, you know, Larry and Brennan write the, you know, world's best form validator for phone numbers. Mm-hmm. So we take into account worldwide phone numbers. We do, you know, error checking. You know, we may call a web service in the back end to see not only does it meet the, you know, the syntax of a correct phone number, but that it actually is a valid mm-hmm. Area code or city code for that country, you know, as an mm-hmm. instance, right? We could put all that logic into a jQuery function, mm-hmm. and then people could reference that, you know, and anytime that they would need that, it would be available there. We're not going to overload the base jQuery library that they want to be lean and mean mm-hmm. with that functionality.
Yeah.
And I totally made that example up on the fly, and you could tell I was reaching there, but that's the concept of the plugin architecture, just like every other cool plugin architecture, right?
Yeah.
There's going to be some good ones, there's going to be some bad ones. Doesn't matter, because you only need to pull in the ones that you actually need.
Yeah. I've been meeting with a couple of designers, found that they were actually interested in jQuery because they could see what you could do with Flash and they could see what you could do with JavaScript with jQuery. They just felt that doing things with Flash is harder. There's a learning curve more than doing...
So introducing the Silverlight.
Yeah, so doing a little bit of work...
Shameless plug.
doing a little bit of work with JavaScript, you can add a little bit of behavior to your static HTML design and give it some behavior. So you want to open that form or collapse that form, that's like a line of jQuery to like do that functionality. And so I met with them, and a few times now we've done a few things together. We did this interface for tabs. For you click these five different tabs, and the content will resize appropriately through a sequence of animation that we set up. And it was really elegant, and we did it in a few hours together, and they understood everything about it. They since took that semantic structure, the CSS and the JavaScript, and tweaked it a little bit for their actual work projects, and so have I. I since actually took that script and made it into a jQuery plugin that's reusable over and over now.
Right.
And it's just very portable. And one of the great things about plugins, there's an options model in plugins. So if you have your standard set of things inside that's like, oh, I want this always to do the yellow fade effect, and instead of yellow, maybe I want to use a bright pink or something. So you pass that in as an option as the background color. And it gets all kinds of functionality and flexibility in there.
Yeah, if you're an old school VB programmer, then optional parameters are alive and well. You know, so it's the C# guys just don't understand that, but but the VB programmers will understand optional parameters.
Yeah.
So what that does is the plugin assumes that you mean yellow unless you pass pink, mm-hmm. and it doesn't. You don't have to pass null references. You know, if you're calling it and just want yellow. Mm-hmm. Brennan, we got to give people some resources before we wrap up.
Okay.
So the main jQuery site is jQuery.org, right?
Yes. There's a ton of stuff right on there. There's documentation, there's plugin libraries, all kinds of other resources on there.
Yeah, and there's live code previews, which is kind of cool. So you can actually, you know, say, you know, show me this, mm-hmm. and then show me the code that does it. And I'm always amazed. It's like, well, here's a web page where they pulled the latest three pictures with a tag from Flickr. And you go, oh, let me see this code. And you think it's going to be complicated. It's like one line of jQuery.
Yeah.
And that's the real power of it. You've got a book in front of you. Can you tell us what that book is?
It's called Learning jQuery by Pact Publishing. This is written by a couple of the guys that are actually on the jQuery team. And it's a really good overview of using jQuery for performance sake. You know, they actually explain why the Fluent interface is more than just for pretty JavaScript. And a lot of other techniques for working with animations. There's a new version of this book coming out that will cover jQuery 1.3, which has added some really crazy features like this live event capability, which I won't explain because it's still so new. And that's worth looking into. The John Resig book, Pro JavaScript Techniques, is really good. It's a little bit dated for me, I guess, but if you really want to unlearn some of the bad stuff that you did 7 years ago, I recommend getting that book, going through it. There's about, you know, out of the 10 some chapters in there, there's probably five that you need to really focus on. You don't need to learn how to make your own jQuery engine because you've got one now. So, you know, he gets into that.
Yeah, but it's a good primer if you want to understand, you know, how things work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but one of the best books since that has been the Douglas Crockford book, where it's called, what was it called again? JavaScript, the Good Parts.
Right.
Where he explains all the really bad things in JavaScript and all the things that can cause problems. The one first thing that I learned from the book was about the radix, which I didn't know what a radix was. When you use a tool that that Crockford built, he built this lint tool where you can have it scan your JavaScript source file and tell you what's wrong with it. And it would always complain about not having a radix value for my parse int. And I learned that when you parse a string value, try to get a number back, the second parameter is the radix, meaning is it base 10, is it base 2, or is it base 16? If you don't specify that, and maybe the leading character is an F followed by a 1 and a 2.
It'll assume it's a hex.
Yeah, it won't be 12. So it'll be a completely different number, and it'll cause you problems. So if you just pass in comma 10, you're fine. Common problem, but, you know, it's easy to solve by just making sure you do that. That's a tool that you can actually.
That's also got to increase performance because it's not having to do that check to see what the assumption that that this value is a hex or a decimal.
Yeah, and I have a version of that JS lint tool integrated as a tool in Visual Studio, so that I can go up to my tools menu. I set it up as a custom tool. I think I've explained this on my blog, where you can go and basically say run JS lint, and in the output window, it will actually tell you which line of code has a problem. You can double click on that line; it'll go to that source code and help you fix it. So that's great. It's all from Douglas Crockford. His book is less than 100 pages long.
Cool.
But every single page has something very useful to know. So I highly recommend that book.
And the book I want to mention is I think before we were recording, you said you hadn't read this one, the jQuery in Action. It's a Manning Press one. I just finished that one. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
We'll have links to all the books that you mentioned.
Well, and there's
in
one
the
more
show
book
notes.
That's not out
one
yet.
More?
Resnick
okay.
is going to be writing or finishing hopefully soon. A book called JavaScript Ninja, and it's going to be a really good book. I've got some preview chapters of it so far. I think it's probably delayed because they want to cover 1.3 for jQuery and all the other things that have happened in the last year. A lot has changed in jQuery since 1.2 to 1.3. I'm waiting for that book to come out so I can learn a lot more new tricks.
Okay, final resource. What's your blog?
Offwhite.net is my site. So to go view to my blog is brennan.offwhite.net. And just go ahead and click on the tags for JavaScript or jQuery, and you'll find content related to this.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being on the Thirsty Developer.
All right, thanks for having me.
So, Dave, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry.
You're officially done with your project in Seattle?
Yes.
Excellent. So now we're going to get you back on the show a little more often. Although, even for you being gone for 3 months, we had you on a number of interviews.
Yeah, that's right. So, back in action, back from the project in Redmond. So we finished, well, at least my portion of the project is finished up. There's still quite a bit of work to do. There's, you know, kind of been some hiccups during the project just because of what Microsoft is doing and how we're evolving and just the project and people involved. But we did some great work, I think, and I try to post most of it on the blog. But like I said, there's still quite a bit of work to do, and we still have people working on the project.
DaveBoss.com/blog, right?
That's right.
And you have your developer diary. I think you have like six parts up there.
Yeah. So kind of walking through the steps of what we were doing, addressing what the problem space was, and it was all about doing B2B transactions utilizing cloud services.
So our buddy Wade Wigner was on the project before you. I would like to get the two of you on the show and interview, you know, you both about what the project is.
Absolutely.
You know, kind of as a full-length interview, and that'll be weird for you, right? You actually being interviewed on the show.
Exactly.
So we had a good interview with Brennan, you know, about jQuery,
mm-hmm.
and it's really fantastic technology. I think that, you know, as people listen to the interview, they saw my passion for it. You know, I'm really getting into it lately.
You're learning JavaScript again.
Again, yes. But more than that, I'm learning the great framework that it is. And it's making me appreciate ASP.NET Ajax even more as I'm, you know, learning jQuery. Believe it or not, I'm actually using both in some of the things that I'm working on.
So let me ask this question. In what case are you using both? Why would you use one over the other?
That not on a single page, but in different things that I'm doing, I'm switching back and forth between, you know.
Okay, so where one provides better functionality in one aspect, another one can provide.
The server-side component in ASP.NET Ajax is just unbeatable.
Right.
The fact that the two work in concert with each other. You know, calling web services, you can't beat, you know, ASP.NET Ajax. For the client-side bling, and also for the really compactness.
I think they call it glitz.
Glitz and glamour. But I have one quick question for you. Before we get to the website, you should know.
Yep.
Dave, Are you more of a Rhea guy or more of an Ajax guy? So we have two different technologies that can really spice up your client front end. We have the Ajax family of products, and there's a number of those.
Yeah.
And then we have, you know, technologies like Silverlight that there's a trade-off between the two, right? You know, you have the plug-in, you get some advanced features because of that plug-in, but which way do you lean?
So it's a great question, Larry. If I look at my past, right? So my past sort of part of my career is building web applications back in 1995, and all the way, you know, up until recently when I joined Microsoft, is that, you know, I was doing all Ajax because we didn't have essentially Rhea type development back then. I mean, yeah, we had Flash, but Flash wasn't really at the level that it is now.
Flash wasn't Flash back then.
No,
you know?
it wasn't the
full rich internet application platform you have now.
But, you know, so we did a lot of JavaScript development, a lot of client-side development. I would say that, you know, in the early years, we were doing some pretty amazing stuff with JavaScript and things like, you know, Microsoft was providing these things called behaviors, which they have now built into the framework itself, that we were able to do things like call web service and stuff. But there was no framework components. We were doing all this stuff essentially by hand, if you will. You know, could provide
from scratch.
Exactly. So now we have these great frameworks, and it's kind of like I wish I was back in those days of building those applications that were very difficult and took us a lot of time to build because we didn't have all these little tools at our disposal.
If you had the tools then that now,
yeah, it would be completely different. So, but I mean, so my past development, it was all JavaScript, you know, JavaScript at heart. You know, it was always fun debugging back in those days. Even though Visual Studio could debug JavaScript, you still had to do the, you know, sort of the alert statements, you know, I'm here, now I'm over here. The value of this is object, you know. And but Visual Studio, starting with really 2003 and 2005, I guess, you could debug JavaScript, but it was very difficult to do. But now in 2008, it's a matter of setting a breakpoint and going. So the tools have gotten much, much better. The frameworks have really matured and made available, so you can do some amazing things. But also, you know, kind of looking at the opportunities with Silverlight now, and, you know, you as a .NET developer can build some pretty interesting applications, not necessarily great-looking applications because we're still developers after all. You still need designers to help with that.
You don't get the glitz by default.
Yeah, so exactly. So I guess I would have to look at the situation of, you know, what is it that I'm building? You know, where can I be more productive at? You know, and I guess, you know, if Silverlight is a good fit, I would definitely go down Silverlight because I think I could be more productive. But if I was kind of doing more kind of a reach thing or, you know, maybe something in Silverlight, you have to do a lot of, it doesn't really support it out of the box. Maybe you'd have to do it in the JavaScript side of things. So I think it depends on what you're building.
That's a good answer.
It's my typical consultant answer.
Right. It depends.
It depends.
Right.
Yeah.
So should we move on to the website you should know?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
So what's your website?
So you're going to throw me out first, right?
Right.
So, well, you know, being on this project in Redmond, we were doing a lot of working with the .NET Services Bus. So inside of Azure and the Azure Services Platform, they have this piece called .NET Services that provides, you know, access control service, the workflow layer in this .NET Services Bus. And so .NET Services Bus allows, you know, separate applications to communicate with one another utilizing standard-based internet protocol. So the man behind .NET Services Bus is Clemens Vasters. And
he's a stud, isn't he?
He is a stud.
He's so cool.
And so what I was working with Clemens or you know, in communication with Clemens quite often about, you know, how do you do this? How do we do this? How is this working? They just recently released a new release of the .NET Services component of the Azure Services Platform.
The March CTP,
The March CTP, right?
Yep.
And there's actually a lot of new functionality in there. The problem is there's
queuing and stuff like that.
Yeah, queuing, routing, all this kind of stuff. And the problem is that the documentation is very minimal. And when I say minimal, I mean non-existent.
Okay.
So what Clemens is doing, he's been blogging like a madman, trying to provide some blog entries about kind of what the new services are in the .NET Services Bus. So I'd point everybody to go check out what Clemens is writing over on his blog. You can go to blogs.msdn.com/ClemensV. So Clemens is C-L-E-M-E-N-S-V.
And we'll have a link in the show notes.
Yep.
So I've been messing around a lot with some web stuff, as we talked about in the interview. And as I'm doing that, I'm starting to learn a lot more about the standards-based web and the importance of having like a good, you know, DOM and having a doc type that's appropriate, you know. So I'm actually going to point everybody to the W3C validator. That's a tool on the internet that will let you, you can do it a couple different ways. You can point your web page, you can point it at a web page. So URL like, daveboss.com/blog, and it'll actually validate your web page for correctness. in the presence of the DTD doc type definition that you've got on the page.
Right.
So it does take into account what you've got. It doesn't have that this high and mighty rules. It's saying, hey, we're going to make sure that your HTML is valid for what you said it's supposed to be.
Well, so let me ask this question. So people who don't know what this whole DTD doc type definition is, what is that exactly?
So that's a construct in XML, but it's also applied to HTML pages as well. That it basically says this is a definition of the document that follows. So I'm going to describe to you the standards that it should follow.
Right.
So it's basically checking your document against the spec and against what you say it's going to be.
Yep.
And this is very important because as you start doing stuff with JavaScript and messing around with the DOM itself and also with CSS, you want to make sure that you're well-formed from a document standpoint before you start that kind of thing.
Right.
You could wind up chasing your own tail.
Now, let me ask this question. So when we just released IE8, this is something I need to look into myself. So we just released beta 2 of IE8.
We released the actual product.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm still on Windows 7 beta, which we haven't got our team release on that.
Right.
But when they were building IE8, they actually built a number of different test cases. And this was around CSS? Or
right.
Was this around standards
as
well?
That was around CSS support.
CSS support. So
but
how does that work?
But it's important to make sure before you start testing for valid CSS that you have valid HTML.
Right.
Because the HTML being broken could break your CSS.
Right.
There's also on the W3C site CSS validators as well, because you got to make sure your CSS is correct.
Right.
And accurate. But what the CSS test that they released as part of IE8, they turned them over this full set of like 7,000 test cases or whatever.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
Yeah, and they're actually on the W3C site as well, so that you can go to your browser that you're testing and making sure that it is following the appropriate, you know,
so Microsoft
CSS.
Built these test cases and offered them up to W3C.
Yes, and what's cool about it is they actually released them under the Creative Commons Attribution License.
Mm-hmm.
So people can take this test case, and as long as they give Microsoft the original attribution to them, they can expand the test cases, add test cases to it,
yep.
Build them into tools, and they can do cool things.
Yep.
It's the IE8 team's way of giving back to the community
sure.
as a whole.
I definitely got to look into that, see how that all works out, and also see about what I can do to sort of learn what it means to build towards standards, because I've been living in the Microsoft world for so long. There's other stuff exists outside that world, so we have to figure out what that means exactly.
Yes, sir.
Cool.
So we wrap it up?
Let's wrap it up.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com or send us a message on our new Twitter account, twitter.com/thirstyd. This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number
50. I, you know what? I would really, really like to get this done today.